Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have three published novels. My latest is titled Lolita Firestone, a supernatural novel, and it is set in Sedona, Arizona and Cairo, Egypt. My previous novel is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. And my first novel is named Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. All three novels are listed in the episode notes. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. Now, on with our program.
In the spotlight is Vanessa Riley, who writes historical fiction, historical romance, and historical mysteries from the 1750 through 1830 time period, basically the Regency era of British history. Her latest book, or one of her latest novels, is Queen of Exiles, a novel based on the life of an extraordinary Black woman from history, Haiti's Queen Marie Louise Christophe, who escaped a coup in Haiti to set up her own royal court in Italy during the Regency era, where she became a popular member of Royal European Society. Vanessa Riley herself is Black. Vanessa Riley herself is Black, keenly intelligent, and I don't just mean in the artistic sense, but also technically, which is rare to have a person who's both artistically and technologically or scientifically intelligent. So get this, Vanessa Riley holds a doctorate in mechanical engineering and a master's degree in industrial engineering and engineering management from Stanford University. She also earned a bachelor's and a master's degree in mechanical engineering from Penn State. Yes, she's a Nittany Lion. That is a Nittany Lion. And her research skills.
And a Stanford tree.
And say that again, Vanessa.
And a Stanford tree.
And a Stanford tree. I thought it was cardinal.
Well, we have both.
You have both. Okay. The tree is on the logo. Cardinal is the nickname. Having culled that education, her research skills helped to advance the agendas at NASA, General Motors, Hewlett Packard, and several startup companies. But her passion for history and literature won the day, overwhelming her passion for math, and has led to the publication of more than 20 titles now bearing her byline. Vanessa Riley, what can I say? She's a force of nature. Welcome to the program, Vanessa. Appreciate you taking the time.
Hey, Mike, thank you for having me.
You know, I just reading your bio, it made me think that the movie Hidden Figures must have been meaningful to you, about the unsung Black women mathematical wizards who helped NASA accomplish its space missions. I assume you've seen that movie. And did that resonate with you at all?
Oh, absolutely. Katherine Johnson and the other mathematicians that helped land a man on the moon and bring them back safely. It's Blacks, African-Americans, we've been always part of this narrative, this historical narrative. And anytime that we can uncover these very brave, brilliant people who made a difference, I'm all for it. I think we're losing too much of that in today.
So let me ask you, as a Black author, do you feel that you have certain responsibilities that, say, a white author might not have, or do you dispense with that sort of notion altogether?
As an author in general, reporting on the past, I feel it is my responsibility, everyone's responsibility, to be as accurate as possible, to be respectful. Even if the people we are writing about, we do not hold their values, they made decisions not in vacuums, but on the politics on the ground, their faith. They were logical. They don't do things irrationally. So you have to kind of divorce this 21st century mindset and being respectful of these people that you're bringing back to life. I realize, because of the research I do, this may be the first time people are hearing about Queen Louise, or they're hearing about Grand Toya, or they're hearing about the Empress of Haiti, or they're hearing about the first and only Queen of Haiti. I understand it. I accept that responsibility. That is not everybody's lens, but not everybody's writing about these people.
Now, the Queen of Exile is a true, is it fiction, non-fiction? I mean, clearly there's a history there, but it is a novel. Is that right? Sort of a, like The Executioner song, kind of a true life novel?
Yes. So yes, it is, it's fiction. Unfortunately, you know, Marie-Louise did not leave a diary. I had to go back and translate a lot of French from the court records of the Haitian court. I referred to Thomas Matteo, who was alive during this time frame and wrote of the history and these particular people. You know, I went and searched through ungodly numbers of old yellowed newspaper clippings in order to find her story. But the fiction, that's all the historical part. The fiction is I put the motivations, looking at what's going on, understanding her life, respecting her life. I have to make her actions, where she moved, why she chose to do certain things, make sense to a reader who's just now learning about this brave woman, and bringing her back to life, so to speak. So the fiction part is the emotions, the conversations. But the if I say a person was in a particular place, they were in a particular place. The historical record bears that out. So it's a marriage, and every historical author, it's their own decision on how far they want to be historically accurate, and how far they want to use their imagination. I just know for me in this house, I'm going to try to be as accurate as possible because I understand that so few people have done critical analysis of these important women, that I will do everything I can to make sure this representation is as bold and as striking as they were.
Now, you write historical fiction, romance, and mystery between the time period I had mentioned, 1750 and 1830. Why those genres and why that time period?
Let me start with the why this time period. For me, this is the most exciting time period in the world's history. Everybody in the world wants freedom, whether you're those darn Americans in the colonies or you're in the mobs in France that are rushing the Bastille, or you are in the Haitian rebellion trying to oust a world power, or the number of colonies across the West Indies who are striving to be free of not only colonial yokes, but enslavement. There's even divisions within the church of who's praising and worshiping God the right way. It is a hot stew of different factions, but everybody wants the same thing, but no one understands the other person's point of view.
My understanding is one of your novels, is it Island Queen or is it Queen of Exile, has been optioned by a movie maker for perhaps a movie or a streaming series. Is that the case? And which book are we talking about?
Island Queen. So Dorothy Kerwin Thomas, the story, a true story of a woman who began her life in enslavement, literally saves money, buys her freedom, the freedom of her family, builds businesses across the West Indies, becomes one of the wealthiest women in the West Indies, has an affair with Prince William, future King William IV. And then if that wasn't enough, she saves generational wealth for Black women, women, and women of color in the colony of Guyana.
So, interesting. Yes. So what's the status of that? It's been optioned. Of course, things get optioned. And then so it's kind of a waiting game right now. Or are they asking anything of you in order to, are you supposed to flesh anything out for them? What's kind of the status of that project, if you even know?
Yeah, this is it's a marvelous team. Longboat Productions, headed by Julie Robinson of Bridgerton, one of the Bridgerton directors, Adjoa Ando, one of the Bridgerton actresses, and Sony Productions have all got together to bring this to life. Unfortunately, we've just, luckily the writer strike is over, but SAG-AFTRA is still out. So that has slowed a lot of things down. Hopefully, you know, there'll be a contract soon and things can get back underway, because I think it's going to be a very important project to see this brought to life.
That is pretty darn exciting. Bridgerton is a huge hit. My wife and I watch it, and people we know watch that series. So you've got quite a team on this one. Wow. So what is the timeline on that? There's no way of actually knowing whether it's going to get made or not, or have they decided this one's going to go into production?
All of that went up in the air with the strikes. Because, you know, you have to work on treatments, you have to work on the script for the first episode, and all that was ground to a halt with the strike. So, you know, once everything gets back in order and everybody's fairly waged and the world can begin to process again, I think we'll hear some more progress. But for now, it's a waiting game, but everybody is still excited, motivated. It's still under option. So
good reason to have excitement. So, you know, I had been saying on a previous podcast, I had mentioned that if you watch Netflix or any of the streaming channels, it's amazing how many of these are being made after novels. I don't think novelists have ever had it so good in terms of seeing their work hit the screen, which of course amplifies sales. So, it's a pretty exciting time period, and you've been extremely productive. You have more than 20 books now. What is your average timeline in producing a novel from conception to completion? And I realize it must vary, but if you were to average it out, what's your average timeline?
Between 4 and 6 months to get a really solid draft that I'm ready to share with my editors at William Morrow or at Kensington Publishing.
That's fast.
But you see, part of this is prior to writing, I spent about 10 years building my world. So when I say from 1750 to 1830s, I have a timeline that talks about all the world engagements, all the political fights, all of the aspects of colonization during this period, all the movements of rebellions. So when I craft a novel, it's more so just narrowing in on the person, because I overlay them in this world fabric. And it gives you lots of motivations of why people are doing what they need to do. To me, that's an advantage. And from my engineering background, there's not a database I can't tap to find what I need. If I can't find it, it pretty much doesn't exist. It's one of those beautiful things of being an engineer.
Yeah, yes. And also in this age when we have so much access to information as well. So I want to ask you about, you know, you obviously had an instinct for science. You studied some hard sciences. You got involved in technology and science. And eventually, and then that transition into making the decisions, you want to be a storyteller, you wanted to write fiction. So start with the education that you pursued. From the time you were a little girl, did you know that you were interested in mathematics and other tough subjects that most of us don't have much facility with?
I was actually there's a test they give you back in elementary school to kind of show your gifts, and it's a bunch of circles. I've taken it several times. I'm always dead center. I was good in math, I was good in science, and I was good in literature and language arts. I've won, you know, poetry contests and essay contests, short story contests as a high schooler. I was also, you know, nerd. So I'm on the science club. I believe I was president of the science club. We're going to Olympiads in nomenclature. I still have some of those bronze medallions and silvers and golds. My mother literally sits me down one day. Let me back up. So my father is from Trinidad and Tobago, and he would tell us all these wonderfully rich, nuanced stories of the islands. And as the only girl, he made sure he told me stories about women doing exciting and just wonderful things from these islands' history. My mother was the literature woman. So she's making sure every summer we're reading Shakespeare, or we're reading Austen, or we're reading Baldwin or Thoreau or something like this. So you have this perfect marriage of this plus this science. And my mom literally sits me down and she's like, baby, you always need to be able to pay your bills. And unfortunately, you know, when I was growing up, you had these waves of Black writers who could do this full time, and then there would be nothing. So you would get these, you know, the Harlem Renaissance kind of era writers, and then there's nothing. Then you would get another wave, you know, Toni Morrison, and then there's nothing. You get a Brenda Jackson or a Beverly Jenkins, and there's nothing. So from my mom's perspective, it wasn't a really stable career. So I went the math route, and she's absolutely right. Math pays the bills. So if your kids are ever out there wavering between subjects, let them know math and engineering is the way to go.
Yes.
But I do distinctly remember my engineering bosses, whereas I was on a diecast manufacturing project, and they were like, Vanessa, you need to tone this report back. It's just way too interesting.
A little too colorful for them. They wanted something a little straighter.
A little straighter. Take some of that emotion out there. We're just melting metal, honey. Just melting metal.
Well, so while you're studying science and while you're working, helping out NASA, GM, HP, were you writing then? When did you actually start the writing? I mean, you were writing in high school, for that matter. So were you always writing even as you were doing your dependable technology and science jobs?
Yeah, I was writing. I have journal notebooks. I was writing poetry, or I was writing little short stories to amuse myself. But it wasn't until the birth of my daughter where I literally had to sit down for about 4 months and do absolutely nothing. It was a difficult pregnancy. My husband pulled down some note. He was actually walking on eggshells during this point. Like, honey, you need anything? Because he knew I was going stir crazy. He pulls down one of these notebooks from high school. And it was one of these stories I'd written. Regency story. And I was like, you know what? I know more. I can do this. And so I literally started writing, and that ended up being my first published book, Madeline's Protector.
Interesting. So did you feel that being an engineer didn't quite feed your soul, or was it a situation like that? Or did you just decide, you know, given a choice between the two, I'd rather be writing full time?
No, I wish it was as clean as that. I am a nerd's nerd, will always be a nerd's nerd. So I like figuring out things. I like solving problems and puzzles. I enjoyed every single one of my engineering projects, and working for General Motors, it was amazing. It was, you know, going to some plants in Germany to look at some rollouts, or putting in new rapid prototyping technologies in Michigan. All of these are exciting, but at the same time, I have this other side of the brain that would love to write stories. So when I got back into the habit of writing, I literally have, I would call it four jobs. So during the day, I'm an engineer. I come home, I'm wife and mommy. Then I put these folks to bed. And then from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., I'm writing. So I was doing everything. I'm not a fan of choosing. Not a fan of choosing.
Well, you were burning the midnight oil, 10 to 2.
Yes. You know, it goes back to school, because I used to have these crazy sayings, you know, sleep you can get any old time, grades last forever. That motivation still sticks. You know, there's only so much amount of time and so many windows in the publishing world to get your words and your message out. So write when you can. And I wrote when I could.
Now, are you most creative? I mean, was it just practical to do it that late, or are you most creative during those late hours?
Everybody was quiet and nobody was asking anything of me because they're all asleep.
So it was a time of convenience for you.
Time of convenience.
But you must have been fatigued at time. Do you feel that when you're fatigued, you write any as well or any better? I remember Gail Godwin was the one who one of her suggestions with writing is write when you're tired. And she said the reason for that is that you're more apt to just do the writing and not let that internal censor start stopping you along the way and saying, that's a bad sentence, rewrite it. Instead, just, you know, getting the copy down and worrying about all the cleanup and all the judgments later. So, I just throw that in there, but I'm curious whether when you were fatigued, you felt like there was any kind of advantage or you were as good a writer while you were fatigued, or was it just, hey, this is the time I had and I took advantage of it?
This is the time I had, I took advantage of it. I try to write every single day. So it's a muscle. And I know that greatness is in editing. It is never in your first draft. So you can only edit a first draft. So you got to work through, you've got to get the scenes in, you've got to get the words down. And then you can go back and shape and call and make things look brilliant. But you have to have words on the page in order to do that. So, you know, I don't want to say I sound very mercenary, but I believe in deadlines. I believe right. in getting your work out in.
Some urgency there. And yeah, I mean, it's you kind of take the lunch bucket approach to it. You need to do this every day. I heard you say it's a muscle. And I don't think people think of the brain as much as a muscle, but it's exact. I mean, the brain does amazing things when it's focused and when it uses repetition to its advantage. So when you are writing daily, you try to write every day because you want that momentum, you want that muscle to grow or at least be as toned as possible. Do you have a, like Larry McMurtry, is it five? What was his? I think his was 5 pages a day. Do you have some kind of output that you insist on, or is it just a matter of getting some of the work done daily?
It depends on deadlines. So, you know, there are different points in your writing where things speed up. So for me, you know, let's get 100 words down, minimum of 100 words. Honestly, I target somewhere between 1,000 to 200 to 2,500 a day. But you, one thing, you have to be in the mood. You have to, you know, you're looking at all your pre-notes to make sure that you're still following the motivational arcs, those kind of things that are in your head. But, you know, you've got to get words on the paper. I try, like I said, between 1,000 to 2,500. But if I'm short, I'm not going to beat myself up because I know by the time you get to that last 20% of the book, it's going to fly.
So when you say, now you did say paper and you may have meant that just kind of metaphorically. Do you write on paper? Or do you write on a word processor? How do you write?
I write in Scrivener. Scrivener to me is the most wonderful thing because you can write out of order scenes. And sometimes because some scenes come stronger to you, and then you have to go and, you know, match things back up. But I use Scrivener because you can write the scene cards, you can write them in order, out of order, move things around. You can look at your progress. It gives you a timeline of like how it calculates based on this rate, how many words you have to do that day. So for me, I love it. To me, that is the tool. I've tried Word, I've tried Pages, I've tried a few other ways people get things done. But Scrivener is most streamlined and it works with my brain very nicely.
Interesting. I've heard of it. I've never used it. Now you mentioned that it does tracking. And it sounds like it gives you the enhanced ability to move sections of copy around when compared to something like Word.
Absolutely. I remember one time back before Scrivener, I was writing something and I didn't even realize I had the same chapter in twice because, you know, it's very difficult to see the global perspective of a novel when you're in Word because it's just page, page, page. This literally is scene is, it puts it all back together when you compile it. So it's got scene cards, chapter folders. You can see it. And to me, it's a visual map of your novel. And you can move things around quite easily. And I sometimes write on my phone. There's a mobile version, there's an iPad version, and then there's a desktop version. So it moves with me.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. You got me wanting to check that out now. like I said, I've heard of it, but I've never used it myself. You mentioned your Oh, go ahead.
Only use the minimal functions. And then when you feel like you know it better, experiment, because that's another thing. It's got everything. It's got snapshots. I have all my research in the research folder. So my files are really, really huge. But if you do all that, you can get overwhelmed. So just the basics. So you just need a chapter folder and scene cards in it, and then you're done. You know, do the basics.
Gotcha.
And you'll love it much, much better.
You start with Word's got many, many more capabilities than almost anybody uses. And I can imagine Scrivener, when you're getting started learning something new, it can be overwhelming when it's got so many different things to offer. That's a great piece of advice. So start with the basics and expand from there if you need it. Mm-hmm. You mentioned your dad, and he said some powerful things to you. But your mom, I've heard you say that your mom was your hero. Tell us about your mom.
Louise Riley was an amazing woman, strong in her faith. She's the kind that will pray for you, put your name on a note piece of paper, and actually keep that paper until things changed and moved in your life. Woman of very strong faith, very, very much into literature. So she made sure her children just loved words, loved the way things were structured on the paper. She also tortured us. She made us read Hiawatha and things like that, which were really, really, really long and boring. But she made up for it with Shakespeare and Romeo and Juliet. And then we, you know, moved to Austin and Mansfield Park and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice. She made up for it. So we forgave her.
So true or false, it's never been. Now you're an established author, so this doesn't count for you as much as maybe some people who are listening. It's never been a better time to be a Black author in America.
I think that this, if you're part of any marginalized group, unfortunately, it took George Floyd's death to really open up and make people examine their reading habits, the seats at the table. Black authors have always found a way to make it through, but that making it through, becoming mainstream, it's always been a small pool of authors that have been deemed acceptable by the publishing world. So right now, a lot of those gatekeepers are open, but we need people to continue to read diversely. We need people to continue to be curious about other populations. I say all the time, I've read over 10,000 books written by people who don't look like me, who don't worship like me, who don't have my complexion. I find very few people in that perspective doing the same thing. I read books because they are good books. I read books because I want to be changed and motivated, and I want to see the world a little differently. And I think there's some great writers out here who are doing the work, who are putting out phenomenal books, but people still think that there are some who still think that if it's a Black writer, that it's not for me. If they're talking about a time in history where people did bad things, then I don't want to read this book that's going to make me guilty, as opposed to, you know what, let's just see how people survived and how people learn to thrive within their circumstances. Maybe there's something we can take away from that.
Because of the kind of novels you write, they require research. Is research, do you enjoy the research more than the writing? Is it a wash as far as that goes? I know people who say, I love doing the research, and in the end, well, I got to write something.
I'm a stick right in the middle. I love research and I love writing. Research is my superpower. And I've been very fortunate to chase rabbit holes that have been bountiful. One of the rabbit holes, we talked about a rabbit hole, was literally finding a comic strip or a little political comic, which had Prince William and Dorothy Kirwan Thomas. If I hadn't found that comic, I wouldn't have wondered who was this woman. To a little context, the artist Gilroy, whenever he does a cartoon, women are always jokes in his cartoon. So he makes us look homely or garish. And if he has a chance to draw a Black woman, he's going to put every ignorant slur you could think of in this cartoon. But this particular cartoon, the woman is drawn beautifully. This beautiful Black woman is drawn, and she's being lovingly embraced by Prince William. She's not the target of the joke. She's the truth of the piece. He's literally telling you this is what your prince, your sailor prince, is up to. And then by following him, I find Dorothy Kirwan. So I've been very lucky of being able to put these pieces together. With Queen of Exiles, she's a footnote, sort of the wife of a military general. Thomas Matteo, he is writing the narrative of what happened in the Haitian Revolution. 10 years, he's interviewing principals, and he just barely mentions this woman who's the wife of Henri Christophe. And then I look a little bit later on, and I find out that she's the first queen of Haiti. And I'm like, how do you go from just the wife of a soldier to be the queen of Haiti? And, you know, all of the weeds and the messiness of the building of the kingdom, and then the sweeping nature of her escape and rebuilding her life with her daughters in Europe completely confounds all of the typical talking narrative points. I've been very fortunate. One of the other questions would be, sometimes my research makes me angry. Because I hear historians, and I'll put that in quotes, talking about Louise, and they make her sound poor and ostracized in England when she arrived. But in the same breath, they talk about all these plaques being put on these beautiful homes in the most expensive real estate in Europe, or in particularly London and in Hastings, that she owned. It can't be both. Logically, you would have to figure out what is the construct, but you know, it took an engineer to go through all the news clippings and rebuild this woman's life and realize that she rebuilt her husband's fortune and lived like a queen and with her two princesses in Europe, recognized by other kings and principals in Europe. Hardly not ostracized at all.
Tell us what writing does for you from a emotional, mental, spiritual standpoint, because there's a lot of different things you can do with your time, and a lot of people struggle with writing. What does writing do for you on an emotional level or spiritual level?
Writing for me is joy. There is nothing more satisfying than reconstructing a narrative, making a reader feel like they're in the room where it's happening. They're watching the politics play out, or they are falling in love with a character, or they're running for their lives because they're in a murder mystery. it's fun to me. This is putting the words together, and then shaping and culling and these passages you've written so that you get a nice tight narrative that's moving you through these people's lives. To me, that's exciting stuff. It's fun.
How much stress or frustration do you feel? Most people, writing's difficult. Even if they love the writing, it's difficult for them, and it's frustrating. It can be stressful. Do you experience stress, frustration, maybe the occasional writer's block, any of that?
For me, frustration is the other things you have to do other than writing. So you have to do, TikToks, or you have to do, social media, things that are extremely important to get the word out, but it's taking you away from the writing. I get frustrated when I go into a sink and I've been watching Instagram reels for hours when I should have been, you know, doing that word count. So
it can be addictive.
Things are too fascinating. They're too interesting because, you know, this everything that we're seeing is almost like a real-time historical of what people will be looking and reanalyzing in the future. And so I get drawn in from that part. But then I remember, right, I was supposed to be writing. I've got to close up this app and get back to work. So that's the frustration part. All the things you can do in addition to writing.
So what do you consider the strongest part of your writing game? I'm thinking in terms of there's, you know, narrative, dialogue, there's pacing, there's characterization, a lot of different aspects to writing. Is there one that you consider to be your writing superpower?
I would say characterization, because I want you to be in the head of the characters. So sinking you into that world, so you get the, you get all the senses evoked. You get a real sense of who these people are and their motivations and all the conflicts. I love the conflicts, the ways that we as humans torture ourselves with the multiplicity, the multiple ways we can move and do and act and choices. That's fun on the page. That's exciting. And I think I do that well. The research, if I mention a street, it's a real street. If I mention a building, it's a real building. I want you at that granular level, no matter what I'm writing, whether it's a romance, a mystery, or historical fiction. Those are real places. I want you walking in their shoes.
Now, Queen of Exiles is one of your latest novels. There's also one called Murder in Drury Lane, which is a Lady Worthing mystery. You came out with two right on top of each other, it sounds like. Talk to us about Murder in Drury Lane. What's that all about?
Well, when I was doing research for my last year's historical fiction, Sister Mother Warrior, which is Georgia's literary fiction book of the year, by the way, about the two women who shaped the Haitian Revolution, I found this really strange fact that in 1806, all the abolition movements in the world stopped. William Wilberforce, everyone is standing around trying to figure things out because Haiti's free. It's kind of like, yeah, we were good with y'all having your freedom, but now y'all want to run countries? I don't know about all that. And then so I kind of imagine, what if you were a woman that had a title, that you had money and access, and you thought the world was turning right and now it stopped? What would you do? So Lady Worthing is trying to get the abolition movement restarted. So the books have a lot of the abolition politics. When things are up for a debate in Parliament, you get snippets of that in her dialogue. But at the same time, people keep dying around her, and she's got to solve that. So she's kind of like a Jessica Fletcher type character. Because I always thought Jessica was, Murder, She Wrote. Remember every time Jessica went somewhere, somebody got killed?
Yes, I used to watch that series, yeah. Angela
That's
Lansbury.
So, right. But it's really fun because, I went to Drury Lane and I found that there are tunnels, or used to be tunnels, underneath the theater that go straight to the pier on the Thames, so that the sailors could come through the tunnels to help work with the rigging for the curtains and those kind of things. And I'm with I took this tour and I was with my daughter. She's like, please, mom, don't ask them how to kill people in the theater. We want to get out of here.
Now, there are a lot of authors out there who have a voice. I mean, Hemingway had a voice. Isabel Allende has a voice. When you pick up something they've written, you start to read it, you recognize their voice. What about Vanessa Riley? Do you feel that you have a voice? Because there are other authors who just decided, I have to have a different voice for each thing I'm writing because I'm trying to embody what I'm writing about. So do you feel that you have a consistent voice, or do you feel that your voice will change based on whatever you're writing about?
I think there's lots of consistencies, but then there are subtle changes based on time periods. So, or the genre. For the murder mystery, you working through the clues, you have to, there's a pacing. When you do the historical fiction, it's lush. It's lyrical. When you see Queen Louise in her regalia, and they're being crowned, I want you to feel the weight of the crown. I want you to feel the actual furs that in this tropical climate were sent for this coronation. I want you to, feel like you were actually there. So you get to be a little bit more verbose, a little grander, because that's what that genre dictates. So I think there's a common thread. There's a lyrical nature in my voice. I think the things that I'm always championing, women's empowerment, strong sisterhood, strong families, you will see that in all of the narratives, regardless of the genre. Very supportive of military heroes. Those are themes that I think that I gravitate towards, that make up part of my voice.
Mm-hmm. So describe your voice. You mentioned lyrical. Are there some other adjectives that you would use to describe your voice, the consistent voice that regardless of what you're writing are going to be the characteristics there?
I think lyrical is the one that I hear most often, because it's hard as a writer. You're looking at, this just makes sense, and this is how I picture them saying things. But at the same time, there is something about white space on a page that's part of my voice, even though it's silent. It's stylistic in the way it is delivered. There is an immediacy. So I sometimes play around with tenses to show the immediacy of the action. But it should resonate. It should make you feel as if you are that lead character and you're seeing things and observing things and feeling things, as if you were that character. So I'm not sure what adjectives those are. If it's something about a power or something about a delivery of lines, et cetera, but that to me is this voice, this statement in not only the words, but in the length of sentences or the length of a line or the way that the lines show up on the page, the order in which they show on the page. That all embodies my voice.
Now, you encourage people to journal. Talk about that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, it's particularly for women, you rarely find diaries. You rarely find the letters that have survived. I mean, we're lucky to have Jane Austen's letters to her sister. We are so fortunate to have Anne Frank's diary. But for the most part, I read men's letters. I see their journals in almost every time period that I'm looking at. I know that people are going to be looking back, particularly the COVID era. They're going to be looking at what we're doing now. And this becomes important. There's a farmer in 1810 that was just scribbling his thoughts of the day. And it changes the way, when it was discovered, it changes the way people realize how people actually viewed the world. He was just a simple farmer just writing his notes, talking about the politics that was happening in the day. That is fundamentally important. So mm-hmm. I encourage everyone to just write, tell your thoughts on what's happening in the world, your fears. Because there are historians who are going to be writing, or historical fiction players who are going to be writing these stories later, and you will help them to feel and be what we're feeling and becoming.
Mm-hmm. Talk about when you decided you wanted to be a published author and you started to put your work out there and you started to receive rejections. I don't know how long that process was before you hit the target, but found an agent out there. Were those rejection letters that you initially received, were those, knives in the chest, or did you take it all in stride? Did you just understand that I'm going to This is just what I'm going to face, but it's all about persistence and finding the right person out there.
In the beginning of my career is a little different than now. So in the beginning of my career, I was writing, the way the books I was reading a lot of older books, where point of view wasn't exactly stressed. I do remember, sending out my first manuscript. So I tell everybody, make sure you have a good critique group, because I just let my friends read my manuscripts. And they were just like, girl, this is good. And that's wonderful that you believe in me, but that's not the critical eye that you need. And so some of the rejections were spot on. And then some of them were more so the way that agent looked at the industry. And that agent looking at the industry did not believe that, either didn't know the history or didn't believe that Black people or people of color had a place in the Regency or this particular 1750s to 1830s timeframe. So they thought these books would never be bought. And they let me know in so many very harsh, sometimes ugly terms, about whether I should even continue writing. Let's put it that way. I've saved them too. So, someday I will put them out back into the world.
Yes.
Some of them were beyond cruel. And the thing is, I wonder how many writers they stopped. I wonder how many people out there were given these very horrible rejections. And instead of getting, everybody should mourn them, getting angry and figuring out how to do your job better, gave up because they believe these negative words. So my very first book I told you about was Madeline's Protector. I rewrote this 125 times. And each version was working on something different. So one time was setting, next time was dialogue, next time was pacing, next time was character arcs. And you just name it. In a typical engineering fashion, I iterated my way.
Wow.
That book, that was my very first book.
So each run through, you would focus on a particular aspect of the book, like the dialogue or whatever, and you go all the way through it with that. And then It might be, just your character description and so on. So you took it piece by piece.
Piece by piece, because it's a very engineering thing to do. I don't recommend that for everyone, but
but it worked for you.
Of figuring it out, because when you're looking at per character, looking at their sole focus, and rebuilding it really makes things clear. And so Madeline's Protector was published. Then I got an agent. I won a bunch of awards, got an agent. And my agent, was shopping my next book, and we got some of the best rejections we've ever gotten ever, from major publishers saying they love my voice, they love this work, but were very honest. They did not know how to market it. They didn't know if there was a market. And everybody has to realize the worst thing in the world is for somebody to say yes and blow the marketing of a book. Because it's not their fault. It's your fault. And the truth is, at that point in time, they didn't believe that there was a significant market. So I went ahead and independently published books through 2 through 15. My very first book, The Bargain, with no marketing budget, because I spent everything on editing and a cover, was like, within a week or 2 weeks time, was downloaded, was purchased off of Amazon, like 2,000 copies. It was ridiculous.
Wow. Wow. What a great start.
It was beautiful. And we kept going until around book 15, 16, traditional publishing started knocking on the doors and saying, hey, Vanessa, we see what you're doing there. I think we know how to market you now.
Now, how did they know your books were selling?
They could tell. They could tell on Amazon. You could tell on the different feeds. They, even independent books, you notice how they're selling. And then some of them, my first editor at Entangle, Erin, I believe she downloaded one of the books and read it and just kept, was very persistent for 6 months saying, you need to write for us. You need to write for us. And that series was the first time my books were mentioned in the Washington Post, NPR, and Entertainment Weekly. And it's been nonstop after that. So now we're, you know, got another agent, Sarah Unger at the Nancy Yost Literary Agency is amazing. And we've now have books that are translated all across the world in Romanian, Portuguese, French, upcoming in Italian. You know, it's a wild ride.
Wow. So you mentioned this engineering approach in that early novel. There's also something called reverse engineering, where, you know, you kind of take something apart to figure out how does this thing work, so that we can maybe reinvent something or make something equivalent. So do you ever do that with a novel? Has that been part of your practice where you take a great novel and you kind of disassemble it and ask yourself what makes this work so well?
I, when you're reading, you do learn to have to turn off the little analyzer brain. So I know there is several Beatrice Williams books where I adore the setup, and you're sitting here and you're like, well, why does this work? And you're analyzing, you know, is it the steps that she takes to take you from point A to point B? Is it this radical shift in the character arc? You do that. I do that with a lot of my favorite authors. And then there's sometimes where you just shut off all of that and just enjoy the book.
Now, do you have a memoir in print or under consideration or cogitation or anything like that? Because you sound like a person you talk about your dad, you talk about your mom, your history. I hear a memoir there. Have you written one? Have you considered writing one?
I haven't considered writing one, but my story's not done yet. So that is, you know, all things are open in the future. But I think we're just at the midway point in my career. There are so many things I still want to do, so many things I want to achieve. We're just beginning. A memoir, you know, in my head, a memoir is you're nearing the end, and I'm like, no, I'm still near the beginning.
Oh yeah, you know, nowadays people write memoirs really pretty early in their career. It's almost like, you know, what already? I mean, come on, you're not even 40 yet, and you're writing a memoir and so on. Now you live in Atlanta. I heard you say I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm sitting on the mm-hmm. porch. What do you do while you're on the porch?
I love writing on my porch. So I have a portable keyboard, and I'll sit out there. If the pollen is low, I'll sit out there with a cup of coffee, and I'll just write. And I'll look at the trees, and the trees will tell me something. Or I'll look at the way the wind is moving. Just rustling leaves or branches. And it gives you a moment. It gives you something that maybe you can model. So I love writing out on my porch.
How do you expect your writing will change as you get older? Is that a fair question? Do you have any sense of how it will? I mean, if you look at, you've been writing a long time already. So if you look at where you were and where you are today, not just in terms of your quality of writing, your ability to write. Obviously, you've gotten better over the years, but rather than just either getting better, but just do you expect that there's going to be some kind of changes, qualitative changes, or maybe even going into some different areas, some other genres, or writing something general? Yeah, where do you think you're headed in terms of in 10, 20, 30 years? What will the writing be versus what it is today?
I honestly don't know. I think there are several paths, especially as we talked about film and TV. If film and TV takes off sooner rather than later, that's a big shift. Because, you know, then you're seeing your works opening up parts. It's feeding the industry for parts, very meaty, weighty parts to players who may not have had these opportunities before. So you think about, you know, writing more books to do that. One of the beautiful things was during the pandemic, many stage actors and actresses were turned to audiobooks, and just listening to how my books and some of my peers' books are these almost, I would say, Academy Award, Oscar Award winning performances is amazing. So, you know, I don't know what direction. I'm very grateful for where I am in my life. But like I said, I'm not done. I want the world, and I want it now.
This is one of those questions a lot of authors don't like to answer, but is there one book that is truly emblematic of Vanessa Riley that you would say, if you want to judge me, if you want to see who I am at my core and my voice in its purest form, this is the novel that I would want to put forth?
That would be Island Queen.
Tell us why.
I sat on that book for 10 years. I literally thought I had done all this. Remember, I told you this is the one where I found the comic strip. I had done all this research on this woman because as I was writing books in the Regency, you run into a bunch of naysayers. And naysayers sometimes are extremely loud. And they will say, you have no part of this time period. Or if you were there, if your people were there, they were enslaved. And then you show them proof. Well, okay, well, they were only in the middle class. Oh, you found some millionaires? Well, they never associated with the aristocracy. Oh, you found affairs. Oh, okay. So I had this woman because she embodies everything. She was an entrepreneur. She was wealthy. She was beautiful. She had a circle of friends. Governors would, when emissaries would come to Guyana, she was headed by the governor for as part of the entertainment so that she would host balls or subscription dinners and whatnot. These were the height of fashion, very elegant women that traveled from Guyana, which river below the equator, all the way up to London or to Scotland, you know, and taking about 18 grandkids. We can barely get the ones in the back seat going to Kroger's. This woman is phenomenal. But I sat on this story because I didn't think the world was ready to singularly focus on a Black woman's rise in this historical context.
So what made you think the time had come?
When I ran into Rachel Kahn at William Morrow, she was taking pitches, and I blew this pitch because in my own head I had prepared for the rejection. In my own head, I was even fussing. They charged $25 to take these pitches, this particular cause, the Historical Novel Society. And I was fussing at this because the conference was already expensive. The week of staying in, I think, Baltimore Harbor was expensive. Food, you know, I was fussing at $25 or $20. And I had a friend who was like, you already paid this much. You might as well just pay this $20. And I begrudgingly paid it because in my head it was already a no. And I'm just giving you $20 to tell me no. But I went ahead through it. And as I was pitching the story, I said, I had a bright idea. I'll pitch it as this affair of Prince William and Dorothy Kerwin. And when I pitched that, because I thought that was an acceptable framework, you know, focused mainly on the white prince and his Black lover, that would be an acceptable frame. And Rachel says, nope, we've heard enough books about him. And I said, okay. Well, let's talk about the two Dorothys, because he has Dorothea Bland, his lover in England, and then he has Dorothea Kerwin in the islands. She's like, no, we've heard enough about Dorothea Bland. So I was like, well, I've just blown this. And then she's like, tell me about Dorothy Kerwin. And I told her the story, and she literally buys it at the table. She's like, I've been looking for a story that will singularly focus on a Black woman's rise in this particular time frame. We haven't seen anything like it. This is the book I want. I was shocked. I walked out of the room shaking. I called my agent and I was just, I'm pretty sure I didn't give my daughter away, but this is what happened.
So let me ask you, if you could invite three authors, living or dead, to dinner with you, spend a couple hours with you, having a nice dinner, what three authors would you call to the table?
Eva Rutland. She was the first, one of the first Regency authors, I think for Harlequin or HarperCollins. She was a Black woman writing in this time period, but many people did not realize or did not know she was Black. And just, she was the first writing Regency. I feel like I sort of have her mantle. The next would be Octavia Butler, because she broke so many conventions and her stories are so powerful and exciting. I would love to just be in her presence. And the last one would be Maya Angelou.
Mm-hmm.
The way she lyrically connects to the reader, telling her stories, is such a powerful thing. So that was an easy one, man. I thought you were going to ask me something hard.
Well, yeah, you didn't even break stride. You knew exactly who you wanted at that table. That is good to hear. Is there a question that you never get asked when you're interviewed that you wish the interviewer would ask you?
How do I take rejection? That's a good one. It's very frustrating. One of the reasons, pretty much in any book that you pick up from me, I have a detailed author's note, and sometimes I even put a bibliography, because the rejections of, or just the bad comments of people who don't know the history but believe that because they watched the 1995 version of Pride and Prejudice, they know everything about this period. That's the Annie version, which is the best version, but they believe that's canon, or they read Georgette Heyer and they believe that's canon, and they don't realize that she made up some of her facts, or that some of her work is slightly, you know, anti-Semitic and things like that. They ignore all of this, and they will pick at things that are true because they've never heard it before. They haven't heard it from someone who looks like me. So that used to be extremely frustrating. But like I said, I every time you get a bad review or a bad rejection, you get to cry. You get to, you know, sob. You get to complain to your girlfriends or your all of your friends. But you got to not let it stop you. So, yes, I will have my shout fest. I will fuss. I will eat chocolate. But then I'm going to get right back up and write.
That's a key, isn't it? Is perseverance. You just get right back on the horse and ride it even faster. Well, my guest has been Vanessa Riley. She is author of Queen of Exiles and Island Queen, and also Murder in Drury Lane and a lot of other books. So if you have not read her, in fact, Vanessa, let me just ask you this before we depart. Is there, if somebody was looking to, Vanessa sounds interesting, I haven't read any of her stuff. What's a good entry point? Is there any particular novel that you think for the first time reader of Vanessa Riley, start here and go from there?
If you're in the mood for historical fiction, I would definitely choose Island Queen as your main entry point. All of my historical fictions are single titles, so you could read them any which way out of order. System of the Warrior is brilliant if you want to, especially if you want to understand the war structure of the Haitian Revolution. And then Queen of Exiles, if you loved Queen Charlotte but want to see at the history of an actual Black queen who walked in life as a Black queen who reigned, Queen of Exiles is for you. If you feel like reading about somebody getting killed, go to Lady Worthing. She's got your number.
Vanessa, thank you for coming on the program. Really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been fun.